okay, let's say the router is connected in through a Verizon connection, and then that is connected, hardwired through the Cat5 connection to my computer, but basically the computer is after the router on the wired connection. Now, the only extension connection is the wireless. So how is someone going to be able to find the needle in the haystack, my computer, on the internet? In other words, I'm missing something here. It's just, and especially since my computer already has firewalls built into my operating system. So maybe you can just spread a few more words on that one. It just sounded, it went very quick.
You want to approach that one, George?
Sure. In your case, it sounds like you're taking all the right steps, so that's a very good thing. But again, you know, there's lots of kinds of hackers, but I'll divide them for purposes of this discussion into those that are just looking for something to hack, and it doesn't matter what they do, you know, it's convenient or it's in their neighborhood or whatever. If you put up the kind of barriers we're talking about, you're going to be okay. They're going to move on to the next victim. On the other hand, if somebody is deliberately out to attack you or your system, either because of a personal grudge or whatever, then it takes a much more concerted effort on somebody's part to make the system bulletproof. And doing things like MAC addressing and so on are very good things to do, so I'm not knocking them. But MAC addresses can be spoofed. It's very difficult to make a wireless system truly bulletproof. WPA2 encryption with a very strong password that's a minimum of 15 characters long is your best bet.
Wow, 15 characters long. The problem I have at some of the industrial sites I work at is they force you to change the password so damn frequently that I keep running out of passwords.
I have to go keep the password on your computer.
Oh, yeah. They may force you to change the password so frequently they end up writing it somewhere that's awfully obvious. But Frank's got the solution to all this. Go ahead, Frank.
Okay, my only other comment is for anyone who's really interested in internet security, there's an excellent website. It's called the Gibson Research Company. They're at www.grc.com. And the man who runs it, Mr. Gibson, well, the opening screen you get is an ad for his software, SpinRite, which is an excellent piece of software that allows you to correct problems with your hard drive. But if you click on it and just go into the rest of the website, you'll find all kinds of information on setting up both wired and wireless networks with specific attention to security. And in fact, I believe he still does it. You can click on a button and he'll actually send out signals to test your computer to see what ports are open and which ones should be closed, how well your firewall is working. And again, anyone who really wants to take the time to ensure security, I suggest going to that website.
Okay, let's make sure we got that right. Gibson Security Company. I expected it to be GSC, but it's GRC. www.golf.
Gibson Research.
Gibson Research. Okay, so it is GRC.com. Very good. We got it.
Golf Romeo Charlie.
We got it. How'd you know I'm going to hear you when you talk to me?
Because you're listening, monitoring while you're talking.
How'd you know that? I just stopped you after a while. Okay, anyone have any further questions or comments? Give me your call letters right now, C2LIW. Hey, you guys have been very helpful. Thank you. Frank, Glenn, George, darn good information. And I guess it all got started from whose question was it back there? Not sure now. Okay, Mel, you want to go to your mailbag? K2KEY, K2LIW.
Hey, this is K2KEY, we're going to try to pick out two here because there's a tremendous amount of questions here. Oh, by the way, first of all, let me say something about last week. We did get a number of comments and questions about op amplifiers. There was, you know, about simple information about op amplifiers, which I'm sure there's plenty out there. But for people that want to do their own design, things like that, there's an excellent book. I couldn't come up with the name of the book last week. And I found the book in my library, and it's electronic design with off-the-shelf integrated circuits for engineers by Meikson, M-E-I-K-S-I-N, and Thackray, T-H-A-C-K-R-A-Y, Meikson and Thackray. I happened to run into a situation this week with an op amplifier that I had to replace. And dug out his book and was able to determine a lot of things about original operation with an op amplifier that's no longer available, and what to go through to put a different one in and work out all the formulas and determine what I had to replace and take over.
Okay, so Electronic Design with Integrated Circuits, I think, was the name of the book. But go a little bit slower with the name of the author. Go ahead.
One author, two authors. Z, like in zebra, Scott H. This is initial. Z H Mike N. M E I K S I N. M E I K S I N. And the other one is Philip. Philip, and his last name is Thackray. T H A C K R A Y. Thackray. Got that, Dick? Over.
Okay, Zebra Hotel Meikson, M-E-I-K-S-I-N, and Philip Thackray, T-H-A-C-K-R-A-Y. Am I close?
Great. Very good book. You go through op amplifiers in detail, give you all the math of how to figure out the value of the components, and by just following that information, I picked out the components that were in there, the resistors and the capacitors involved in that circuit. Working it out, I was able to develop, find out the Q, and they also give you a number of ways to set the system up for like a 3 dB point. So it's quite informative. It really worked out quite well, Dick. Over.
Roughly what year was the book published? That tells us something about how current, which isn't too much of a problem, because op-amp, in general, the main theory doesn't change that fast. So roughly when was the book published, if you happen to know when also, what was in, I'm trying to figure, the price, roughly the price of the book. Is it a large format, paperback, or what is it, you got a melt?
Okay, the first publishing of it was in 1980, but it was updated since then. For the most part, there's a number of editions on it. And it's a hardcover book. No, it's not a soft cover, you know, it's a regular hardcover book, and it contains about, total, let me see, what's in the book? Oh, about 400 pages, Dick, over.
What's your guess as to the price of the book?
When I bought it, oh God, many years ago, I think it's in my library, I bet at least 20 years. I've used it quite a number of times in the past. It's got very good steering, very solid steering. The mass is extremely solid on it, and no gaps in it. So if you absorb the chapter, especially on op amplifiers, it applies actually any op amplifier applies to, because it goes through both the original and the most major kinds of op amplifiers that are out there, which are very similar. But it's got the, you know, the ones that are, for instance, require single power supply, ones that require dual power supply, methods of doing it. It's a whole whole thing going way back to the originals and almost just about up to the present, over.
Very fine. Would you guess it's about a $50 book?
Originally, yeah, I think it was, I off the top of my head, it would say, yeah, it was somewhere in that neighborhood. I'm sure. I used to subscribe. There used to be a company, gee, I don't know if you remember it. They used to provide, you know, a hardcover book on, you know, electrical engineering. And, you know, by different offices. No, they were a clearinghouse for it. They used to send me, constantly used to send me, you know, you buy one for full price and get another one at half price. Do you remember that, Dick? Over.
McGraw-Hill is a good one. Wiley is another one. There's a whole lot of companies like that. Go ahead.
Roger. So I used to buy a lot of books. That's where most of my books on the shelf have come from. And, I finally covered, you know, most everything that I was looking for, and then I stopped because, you know, the investment in books became considerable, and I don't know if it pays anymore because I'm sure you can find a lot of this online or go to the library, Dick, over.
Yeah, there's one other very good op-amp book. It's on my bookshelf. I'm going to walk away from the rig for 30 seconds. I'll be hearing what you say because I'm carrying a handy-talkie. So talk for 30 seconds while I go get this other very good book. You got it, Mel, and go ahead with the questions on op-amp, whatever you like.
Hey, Roger. Yeah, well, no, it's not so much questions. I just say to people, there's an awful lot of stuff out there. One of the simpler books that was written on op-amplifiers, I don't know if it's still available through the Radio Shack, was a cookbook. One of their cookbooks, Archer cookbooks. It was by, he was a prolific writer for the Radio Shack by the name of Forrest, F-O-R-E-S-T, and his last name, Mims, M-I-M-M-S, Forrest Mims, that is quite a character, quite a guy, really nice guy to talk to, but he was a pretty funny guy to begin with, very nonchalant. He wrote quite a number of cookbooks for Radio Shack. And that's very simple applications of op-amplifiers. It's a simple theory on them. So you can go from that to the screen here. This one is maybe a little more extreme, but this is for professional engineers. Go ahead, Dick.
Okay, I've got this book in my hand by Analog Devices. It's 8.5x11, 2 inches thick. Does it have page numbers that I can tell about? Now, it looks like each section has got its own numbering system. I'm going to estimate 400 pages. It's only $40. You go to the Analog Devices website, wish I knew that website, and I think I've got the actual order form here so I can figure out what I paid for it. And I think it was $40. It's called Op-Amp Applications, Analog Devices. Very large format. In other words, 8.5x11 for us guys with older eyes. Older diagrams are nice and big. Lots and lots of data about making active filters out of op-amps, as well as many other applications for op-amps. If you want a circuit where you want an input impedance of 100 megohms as an amplifier, there's one of those in there with no capacitive loading. And so on. Extremely good book. And it's by Walter Jung. He's the guy who wrote a book of his own, and then Analog Devices got a hold of him and said, hey, you got to build a book for us. So the author is Walter G. Jung, J-U-N-G, editor. And I got this thing in 2005. I'm about to look and find out when it was published. And I hope it's going to tell me. Nope. Not making it super clear. Copyright 2002 by Analog Devices. Okay. Real modern. And so, yes, it's going to favor that particular brand name of op-amps, but that's not a showstopper. Let me drop.
YO
recognized. That's not a showstopper, because any of these op-amps in here, with rare exception, you can find an equivalent in other brand names. Mr. Wyoga, go right ahead.
Texas, you were given out the title, or I'm sorry, this is KCYO, my name's Bernie. You were given out the title of the book. I did a Google search on it, and the book is out there. Maybe want to browse through it beforehand, but if you'd like, I can give you the direction URL if you want to read out, so thank you for the direction. Does that help a little bit?
Real good to know, Bernie. Okay, so you've looked up analog devices and OmniAmp applications and this $40 book. Your audio is a little bit low, so eat the microphone and tell us how to find it on the website. By the way, I would not download this book from a website. For $40, I'm getting an amount of paper with all of the fancy illustrations and everything all bound just right, mailed to me. If I wanted only a certain section of that book, yes, I would download it. But if I wanted the hold-on book because I suddenly fell in love with these devices, I'd want to buy this book. If I had to print on both sides of the page with my own laser printer, this many pages, wow, I'd burn up a couple of cartridges. Ain't worth it. So if you want the hold-on book, I recommend you do not download 400 pages. Download a section if you want it. But I would go out and buy it. But go ahead, Bernie, with your information.
Before I give that, just as a comment, I agree with you wholly on buy the book. I'm a software programmer, and I really hate it when software packages come with electronic manuals, but then I have to burn two things of paper and a laser printer cartridge, and I'm blessed to have a binding. I can at least find the thing, but it's never as good as having a good old-fashioned book to lean on. Okay, if you want to find this, go to Google and Google this sequence: analog devices, op-amp application. I will see that back again. Just do a Google search of literally this: analog devices, op-amp application, and it should come up as one of the first few hits. Analog devices website is literally analog.com. You'll get a page that has, you can take it down in sections or the whole thing. The whole thing is about 35 minutes. But anyway, I just did a quick verification of the same one as the site shown. So if anybody has any questions, come back out.
Fantastic. 35 megabytes. Wow. Darn good book. A lot of good information in there. And as I said, nice large format, easy to see the diagram. And you digest 10% of that book, and you'll be the equivalent of a maven or a minor genius in your particular company on that particular subject. Lots of good stuff. And as I said earlier, as long as you're not working with purely digital circuits, and there's also analog to digital converters in there, but if you're working really analog circuits, and if you're building power supply, regulator, voltage step up, step down, audio amplifier, IF amplifier, RF amplifier, certain kinds of filter functions, whatever. If you build any kind of analog circuit today, and if you haven't at least considered operational amplifiers, which is usually written down as OP space AMP space amplifier, if you haven't at least considered op-amp amplifiers, operational amplifiers, I think there's a medium good chance your circuit is a bit obsolete. And there are little packages you can buy these days, surface-mount packages, where you have a whole zillion, you know, four individual operational amplifiers in a tiny little package. If you did that with tubes, the same amount of gain, bandwidth, and performance, and whatever, it would take you 100 tubes to do that. At least. If you did it with individual transistors, it would take you 100 transistors. And it can all be in a little bit of a package, you know, approximately a quarter of an inch square, surface mount. And you pay $2 for it or some crazy number like that. You're getting a lot for your money these days. You've got to go that way, in my opinion. And with any further questions or comments, give me a call that is right now. And if not, Mel's going to pick up. K2LIW.
K2LIW.
Go ahead, Glenn.
In your travels, have you ever run across a man named Bob Keys at all?
I've heard the name many times. What company, what specialty?
I believe it's Analog Devices, and he writes a tremendous amount of op-amp different, all kinds of different applications, and pretty much all the different, I mean, if there's anything, he's like the father of op-amp. And I've been to a couple of seminars where he was actually speaking and managed to talk to him a few times, and some very, very interesting things that he's come up with. I was just wondering if you ever ran across him at all. But generally, if you download his book, I'm sure you probably have run across his name in a few spots.
National Semiconductor.
Thank you, National. That's right. That's correct.
Burr Brown used to be one of the really big names in op-amps way back in the dark ages of 1970 or so. And they had a beautiful book called Third Generation Operational Amplifier Techniques. I think I own two different editions of that one. And there's all kinds of fancy oscillators. In fact, believe it or not, I built an op-amp oscillator, an extremely clean sine wave oscillator, out of operational amplifiers, I guess about a year and a half ago. I needed one with very low harmonic distortion, Wien bridge type oscillator, as I remember, running at exactly 1.0 megahertz with no crystal. In order to do a fancy kind of synchronous demodulation I was doing at the time. So sine wave, square wave, cosine, sine simultaneously, various kinds of logarithmic, anti-logarithmic. You can do all of those kinds of functions in analog with operational amplifiers. A really magic little circuit. And we've all talked about the ideal amplifier, where it requires no input to get output, so to speak. Or you know to the nearest microvolt exactly where everything's going to be all the time. Now these little gadgets can do that for you. Anybody any further comments? KQRIW. You got it, Mel.
The Analog Devices op-amp circuit.
You want to give that to him again, Frank? Yeah, what Frank said is you go to, you Google the combination Analog Devices, that's a brand name, and op-amp applications. The name of the book is Op-amp Applications, and the company is Analog Devices. You put those two together with a plus sign in between them, Analog Devices plus op-amp applications with Google, and probably the first website will be this particular book. And unless you just want one little section of it, don't download 35 megabytes. Go buy the book for $40. I heard the QSL, extremely noisy signal. Okay, Mel, you got it.
Hey, this is K2K1, you know, just really quickly. First op amplifier, in fact, I still have it, kept it as an antique, was made by, first one produced commercially, was by Philbrick Nexum Corporation. And it looks like a small version of a 6L6, and I'm not kidding, it had a plug on the bottom, goes into a socket, similar to a 6L6, a metal, if you picture one of these 6L6, the metal version. This is similar to, or I should say, I could fix AG7 too. That's the way it would look. And as far as Keith, yeah, I met him one time. We had a nice conversation a long time ago, some years ago. In fact, he said to me, he said, that should be my call letters. He said, how did you get my call letters? So, with his name similar to my call letters. So, very, very nice name. All right, anyhow, let me see. Looking on here. This is an interesting one here. 1940, that's why I try to pick out really interesting ones here that we can get to. In 1940, my father had a converter in the car, and it used a tube, and I'd like to see if I can resurrect this thing. It uses a tube that nobody seems to be able to test. Can you tell me something why? The tube is a 7N7. Familiar with that one, Dick, over.
No, I'm not. At first I thought he was going to tell us about a vacuum tube mounted vibrator assembly or something like that, which was used in power supplies on car radios way back in the dark ages. 7N7. That strikes me as a metal tube with a grid cap in the top middle of it. Back to you, Mel.
797 is a dual triode with a Loxo base equivalent of a 6FM7.
Wow.
Triode too, all right. But the reason that they used them, let me say this much. The reason they were used because they came up with a 7 series tube for mobile work, for mobile radio. And the reason was that the instead of a 6.3 volt filament, they put a 7 volt filament in so that you wouldn't burn the filaments out. Also, because a number of the car radios, the tubes were in upside down. In other words, you pulled the bottom cover off. You went underneath the dash, you pulled the bottom cover off, and you saw the tubes plugged in underneath there vertically. And these 7 series tubes had a Loxo pin in the middle. And the socket assembly is different. The pins are thinner than you would see regular on a regular Loxo tube. And so a lot of tube checkers didn't really have that socket in them because it was basically only, the tubes were only used for mobile use, except there's one other application that during World War II, a very interesting situation of World War II, I remember about using over.
Was the tube a Loxo tube so that it sort of pushed into the socket and then clicked and held itself in, even though it's inverted in a vibrating automobile? And in some cases like that, didn't they have some kind of a shield that went over the tube that held it down to the chassis to make sure it couldn't wiggle out? Back to you, Mel. And tell us about the World War II application. Also, was Mr. Keyes a ham radio operator? He sounds like one. You got it, Mel?
He had his call letters, different call letters. Now I guess he should get his key because, it's before the vanity call. Yeah, the tube actually had the center pin, the Loxo pin, on it, had a groove in it all around with a keyway. So when you pushed it in, there was, on the socket, there were two little things, like they grabbed the pin. You know, it snapped in, and they grabbed it. They were like the spring pin, spring clamp. And it's locked right in there. I've never seen those tubes with shields, believe it or not. That's the way they made them up. It was basically Motorola promoted that quite a bit back in the 30s and 40s. And right up to the, I can tell you, as long as there were 6-volt cars, basically, that was the tube that was used in a lot of the radio systems. And, yeah, that way, I can say, it kept it from popping loose. Even the vibrators, you know, had that clamp. It had that groove around the vibrator base. So that when you pushed it in and, you know, it snapped in, it would pop out and go over.
Yep, I fixed a few of those in my day. And it was a 1,000-volt capacitor that went across the transformer that the vibrator was connected to. It was a wax-type capacitor, which was trying to suppress the glitches made there, and that eventually would fail and needed replacement. There was a person I know who tried building a K2RIW parallel kilowatt amplifier with 4CX250B tubes. He couldn't afford the 4CX250B tube socket, and he managed to modify a Loctal socket and plug it into his 4CX250B. Not a very good arrangement. Back to you, Mel.
Hey, this is K2KY. Yeah. The tube was actually developed in the late 30s, and it fell into very usual use during World War II. In 1943, the Defense Department at the time did authorize the building, which of course was very unusual because, you know, there was a very big shortage of communications parts and things. They did authorize a company here in Brooklyn by the name of Abbott Instruments to build the first 2-meter transceiver. Now, this is really a 2-meter transceiver, and that was the only thing they were able to get to use in that that was available easily, was Loxo tubes. And so Abbott, called Abbott Instruments, it was the model PR4, And believe it or not, it was a 2-meter transceiver that was placed in New York City precinct that if the telephone system was knocked out or whatever, so the police would have a way of communicating from one precinct to another, and it was supposedly going to be operated by volunteer, that time radar wardens that were hand-picked over.
Wow. Was that 2-meter receiver a super regen, or was it the early equivalent of a gunfit communicator? Back to you, Mel.
The super regen had had two different dials on it, one for the transmit frequency and the other one for the receive frequency. Believe it or not, I have one. In fact, I have to own one. And called, the first time was authorized as called the Police Auxiliary Radio System, operated by non-military personnel. So that was 1942, Dick.
Wow, and it was called the TR-4, which, by the way, the Drake Company resurrected that model number for one of their transmitters, a transceiver, 8-10 meter transceiver, probably in the 1980 time frame. Go ahead.
This thing was a fairly compact unit for its day. It was about 12 inches wide and about 12 inches high and about 6 inches deep. And they used to lock the tubes in them. And so I just thought to see this question about lots of tubes. There was a number of tube checkers around that had these better tube checkers, not the ones you found in the stores like in the drug stores and all. You would never found the Lockwood food stock for testing in that. It was basically only for testing later on TV tubes, radio tubes. But some of the better tube checkers, you will find they have a Lockwood socket if you want to check that too. Guess they're far and few between now, over.
Yep, they are antiques. And so I think you're saying the main reason for that tube was to hold it in position, inverted, in a mobile radio where it's going to get a lot of vibration. And I guess some of those radios were Motorola brand name. Mel, go ahead.
Well, Motorola promoted it, you know, in a big way. I assume that they had their finger in the manufacturing of the tube or whatever. I don't know if it was their patent originally. However, I can say I remember it quite well. I worked on a few of those radios, and I remember that some of the tubes, if they were in the socket for a long time, a corrosion or whatever would set in that and lock that sensor pin. It's pretty tight, and you had to really work on it to pull the tube back out. All right, anyhow, the 7N7, I'm afraid I can't help you really in testing it. You'd have to really check around and find out. Somebody's got a very good antique tube checker, one of the better ones that were made back in those days, and would have an estimate that has a lockable socket on it. And I could say, pretty hard to find this as a, you know, I think there may be, I'm sure it's some out there, but I haven't got the foggiest idea where you're going to find it, Dick, over.
Yeah, and that's a bit out of our area of expertise, a 1942 type tube tester. Oh, well. Time to go on to the next one, though.
But you get a chuckle out of this. I'm going over them once that, you know, nobody can easily handle here. There's a lot of very difficult ones here to answer, so I'm just going to have to really pass up on some of this stuff here. I got a heck of a lot of them here to filter through. Well, here's one that's been repeating itself. Now, this has been coming up quite a bit. I've had about, I would say, without exaggerating, dozens of inquiries with the same question, basically phrased a different way. What in the heck is what really is digital signal processing? Can you please give us a brief tutorial that we can all understand on how DSP really works? That's all you hear now. Every piece of equipment is DSP, but no actual printed material we found tell the whole story on so that we all can understand. I don't know if you want to get involved with this, Dick, but boy, I've seen it a number of times over.
I'll give a brief one now, Mel. When it comes to analog signals, like the audio that goes into your earphones, comes out of your loudspeaker, the RF that flows into your receiver front end or out of your transmitter, analog signals, we all know what that means. You can take a sine wave, for instance, and digitize it. In other words, let's assume now I'm talking about a 1 kilohertz sine wave, and I want to convert it into a digital format with reasonably high fidelity. So I've got the sine wave that goes up 1 volt, down 1 volt, and back to zero. And it takes up 1 millisecond to do it because it's a 1 kilohertz sine wave. And I can decide that I'm going to take a sample of that sine wave every microsecond. So I draw my horizontal graph, I draw my sine wave on the graph, it goes up 1 volt, down 1 volt, starting off at zero, ends up at zero. And now I divide my graph into 1,000 horizontal positions. At each one of those horizontal positions, I take a sample of the voltage. And if I then connect those points, it would be an extremely fine-grained staircase on the original rise time of the sine wave, the rising front. And so each one of those sample points, I put a dot on the screen, I put a dot on the sine wave, and I measure its amplitude at that period of time. There's going to be 1,000 dots because I'm measuring every microsecond over a 1 millisecond period for this 1K sine wave. And if my analog to digital converter could easily tolerate plus and minus 1 volt absolute and converted it to a digital stream with, let's say, 10, 12, 14 digits of resolution. Let's make it 12 digits of resolution. 2 to the 12th power is 4,000. So I got 4,000 possible states of vertical
repeater, timeout, repeater, timeout, cancel.
I got a 10-bit analog to digital converter. 2 to the 10 power is 4,096. So I got 4,096 possible vertical positions that I can digitize, come out with a 12-bit number. If I did that correctly, I think I did. So now I know the vertical resolution, I know the horizontal resolution, I got a string of numbers that now sequentially represent that sine wave. Once I've got it into digital numbers, I now can operate on it losslessly. See, in the case of an analog signal, if I send an analog signal through a whole series of amplifiers and filters and attenuators and all kinds of various gadgets, mixers and so on, as the signal goes down range, stage after stage after stage, unless my circuitry is absolutely perfect, my signal is always degrading a little bit as it goes through each stage, picking up a little bit of noise, picking up a little bit of distortion. My signal degrades. However, once I've got my signal digitized, now it's a set of ones and zeros. As long as none of those ones and zeros get flipped, no matter how many stages I go through, it's still a series of ones and zeros, the signal does not degrade. Let me drop. That's one of the advantages of digitizing the signal. Now, if I'm real smart, and I know how to operate on that string of sequential digits that represents the encoding of that particular sine wave of my example, I now, with a computer algorithm, can do filtering, high pass, low pass, band pass, matching, frequency selection, equalizing. In other words, I can favor the higher frequencies with a slope compared to the lower frequencies. All kinds of fancy operations are possible once the signal has been digitized. And my circuitry that does the operation is a computer program. So today, the circuit, I plug in the program that makes it act like a bandpass filter, and that's what it is. Tomorrow, I plug in the program that makes it a low-pass filter. And the next day, I plug in a program that makes it a notch filter. You can see the adaptability. You change the software, and I change the function. You lay out a circuit with real inductors and capacitors and resistors, it's very hard to change the circuit. If it's a filter today, it's going to be a filter tomorrow, unless I do an awful lot of work on it. But with digital signal processing, I can change the gain, change the frequency response, change the function. I can change a sine wave into a square wave, into a triangle wave, into a sawtooth wave. Just by the digital function I plug in that does the lookup table and transfer. It gives you a little bit of the adaptability of digital signal processing. Nowadays, real good spectrum analysis, particularly in audio circuits, Spectran is a very good example. All of that spectrum analysis, it acts like a very elaborate spectrum analyzer. In reality, it's just your audio card in a computer with a good program. So digital signal processing has a lot of adaptability and a lot of power. That's the good news. Let me drop. It's got at least one piece of bad news. And that is, with all of that power, my goodness, can you misuse it? If my analog to digital converter, the very first step in digitizing that sine wave of my example, if it runs out of dynamic range, in other words, if it can only tolerate plus and minus 1 volt, and my sine wave happens to be plus and minus 1.5 volts, all hell breaks loose. Many an analog to digital converter has what's called the wraparound problem. In my example of a plus or minus 1 volt maximum analog to digital converter, as I creep up to 0.9, 0.99, 0.99 volts, as I get to the top of the dynamic range, what it puts out is all ones. If I give it a little bit more signal than what it's designed for, all of the ones turn into all zeros. It wraps around. So in other words, I've only made a microvolt of change in the signal, but the digital code coming out of my system thinks I jumped from plus 1 volt down to minus 1 volt. It's called wraparound. All my ones turned into all zeros in my 12 bits of digital output. So if you exceed even instantaneously with a couple of spikes now and then the absolute maximum input capability of an analog to digital converter, and you take that bit stream of digits coming out of that thing and put it through your normal process, you get garbage. You get really weird stuff. So that's one of the many problems. Over amplitude drives it crazy. Under amplitude does bad things. If it's made for plus and minus 1 volt, and I'm only giving it plus and minus 1 millivolt, I'm using very little of the dynamic range. The digitizing I get turns into very rough digitizing. And therefore, the signal coming out of there when I process it ain't going to sound very good. So one of the many things you've got to do with a digital signal processor is be very careful about controlling the amplitude of what goes into it, of the signal you're processing. You don't want it too big. You don't want it too small. You need some very fancy automatic gain control circuits, among other things you've got to do. It also has
repeater, timeout, repeater, timeout, cancel.
It also potentially has aliasing problems. I may set up an analog to digital converter that's made to work between 0 and 1 megacycle. And if for some reason I give it a signal of 1.1 megacycles, again, when I come out, it's going to look pretty yucky. So use it properly, it's got a lot of power. Use it improperly, it can give you garbage. So you got to be a little bit careful. But because the logic circuits that can do all these fancy operations are in such tiny little packages, you can buy a an operating system, a computer chip these days, which has got millions of transistors in a tiny little package that's a quarter of an inch square. It can do, with digital signal processing, the same quality of processing that would have required a benchtop of analog circuitry. So you take apart your modern cell phone, which has a lot of DSP in there, and you look at those 7 or 14 layers of that printed circuit board, you take apart those integrated circuit chips and try to figure out what's going on. You're looking at fifth generation, very high-tech hardware, and you buy it for a song because of its mass production. I think I heard tonight that the American public throws away, I think I heard the number of 100 million cell phones per year are thrown away. A big number like that. Boy, is that mass production. And man is putting a lot of toxic waste into the world, if you saw 60 Minutes tonight. K2KEY, K2LIW.
Hi, this is K2KEY. Well, to get into digital signal processing, explain it simply. I usually have to, I've done this before because I've been asked this question also, and I've tried to be a little bit simpler with it. To a Dick says it's all packaged up in a nice little, neat little chip today. To understand how the chip works, basically, it requires really a lot of knowledge of calculus. Things like linear transformations, as Nick was saying, about and differential equations and vector algebra and things of that sort. So it's quite math involved, and so that's why I would try to stay away from the mathematics that would go on and on and on, and even I am not that, I think, knowledgeable in all aspects of it, even though I've worked with it somewhat. I mean, let it drop. Really, I take the path of really trying to simplify, as they say, the mechanics of it. I don't know if we can get it all in tonight. But we want to start really at the beginning of what's going on. As Dick says, analog technology, which, of course, we've been with for quite a while, is mostly what we used to call, we call the passive and active components. Were combined really to produce a signal in a certain way. And so we're all familiar with capacitance and inductive reactances. So this is the way that the departure comes with you know, DSP. To modify the signal in a different way. Let me let it drop.
Kiss the mail when you finish.
All right. Let's see. How can we start to get to the next step here? In digital sampling, we sample the incoming signal, and usually at what we know as a rate that is equal to signal the rate. Oh, the term, the sampling signal term, starts with an N. I can't come, it's too late. It comes up with an N, Dick. What do they call that sampling signal?
Nyquist rate. If I have an oscillator, that each time the oscillator goes through zero, I take a sample, and it's a one megacycle oscillator, that means I'm taking 1 million samples per second. My maximum Nyquist rate would be half a megacycle. In other words, with that kind of a digitizing system, whatever your sampling rate is, divide by two at the absolute maximum rate at which you could get some kind of fidelity of digitization of that signal. You'll get a really yucky answer if you try to digitize a 0.6 megacycle signal at a one megacycle rate. So it's got to be, Nyquist is more than a 2-to-1 ratio between the highest frequency you're digitizing and the rate at which you're doing the digitizing. That's the so-called Nyquist rate. This guy Nyquist came up with the mathematics that proved that. Back to you, Mel.
picture. Yeah, okay. Let's just keep it simple. So the incoming signal is sampled at twice the rate of the highest input frequency. I call that 2 BW. Two times the highest input, significant input frequency. And that includes the noise, everything. Comes in everything. And that's what you're sampling, the whole shebang. Then, of course, they have a lot of filtering. They have a lot of answering filtering there, known as low-pass filtering, that as Dick started to allude to. The low-pass filtering of this signal is to make sure that none of the signals that go through the input exceed one-half of that Nyquist rate. And that's what Dick was saying about that filter. That low-pass filter is what they call the anti-aliasing filter. Correct so far, Dick?
You got it. So your sampling rate, to have any reasonable fidelity, has to be a lot more than 2 to 1. 2 to 1, you just get by. If I'm trying to digitize a 1 megacycle signal, I better have an oscillator of sampling at least 2 or higher. And if not, even if you do that, unless you do a number of other things to worry about what's called the sine x over x problem. And by the way, the latest issue of Electronic Engineering Design, EED, I think it is, magazine, that came in the last couple of days, does have some very nice pictures of a direct digital synthesizer, DDS, which is kind of close to what we're talking about. Digital signal processing and direct digital synthesizer have some things in common. And in both cases, you get aliasing. In other words, the sampling function gives you a reasonable replica of the original signal. But it's got some other little squiggets in there, other little signals that are phony. Call them sidebands, call them intermodulation distortion. That's not what they really are. But they're called aliasing components. Mathematically, you can predict where they're going to be. You can predict how strong they're going to be. If you're a good designer, you have your filtering and your oscillator frequencies set up such that the aliasing frequencies don't fall into your active region, and they fall into regions where your filters eliminate them. So up till now, Mel and I have been telling you the advantages of DSP, and if you're a little bit unknowledgeable about this, these aliasing functions that creep in, which are predictable if you're smart enough and if you studied it enough, read enough articles, could give you some grief if you didn't consider them ahead of time. Back to you, Mel, KQLIW.
Exactly. So if you look at the circuitry, you look at your block diagram, you'll see this anti-aliasing filter system. And you'll notice it, that it always precedes the input to this chip, to the AC conversion chip. And you'll see it, usually the chip is marked ADC. All that means is ADC conversion. That's what the ADC stands for, ADC conversion. So what happens, once it goes through this anti-aliasing filter, that is for the ADC converter, so the filter, even if it's not sometimes with filters, I know they design some fancy filters now, but many a time, even with the best of filters, there's a possibility that something could slip through. So what happens is the input signal, again, back to the input signal, is always 1.5 times the Nyquist rate or greater, as Dick said. Usually, the sampling rate of 2 times is most likely this. Oh, I'm sure passed by quite a bit by now. Now, why do we oversample? That's the question. Okay. The oversampling is actually what makes this anti-aliasing performance in the DSP to process the higher frequency at the data signal. So without, you know, in other words, it imposes a limitation on the oversampling rate, which of course, like Dick just explained, what happens when we oversample. So that is why we have this type of, you'll notice that they have the A to D converter, but before that, you'll notice that intricate filtering system. I guess they just call that anti-aliasing filter. I don't think there's any other name for it. Is there, Dick, over?
I think not. And there's more than one of those in many of these systems. But they've got a lot of power. They take a little bit of study. They're capable of a lot of performance, extremely small package, and adaptable performance. You could, for instance, design a receiver to be used by an astronaut in space, where the receiver has a particular bandwidth when the signal is strong, and the system adapts itself to a more narrow bandwidth when the signal is weak, and therefore it still gets a good signal-to-noise ratio, gets good clean data, but the data is coming at a slower rate. The Voyager spacecraft, way out beyond Pluto, is doing that. It's now down to something like 1.5 bits per second of data rate, because it's a little 10-watt transmitter when it was brand new. It's probably down to 4.5 watts of output now, and it's umpteen billion miles away, outside of our solar system, and still traveling. And NASA was smart enough to program it in such a way that the receiver readjust itself into a more narrow bandwidth so that it's still getting this super weak signal from Goldstone, California, and getting that signal above threshold because the receiver has a narrow enough bandwidth that the receiver has adapted itself to by ground command. To my knowledge, that's a good example of one of the capabilities of digital signal processing, adaptability by command. We've only got about 2 minutes left, Mel. You guys have listened to TechNet number 1213 of the series that began in September of 1982. What is that, 26 years ago? And these guys think they still have something to say. The clan that gathers at this watering hole every Sunday night. 73-year-old, be kind to each other. K2KEY, K2LIW.
A question for KEY and to RSO.
We get into the next step, which is the sampling time, how that comes about, what's known as the sampling process, which is very important part of DSP. So we'll try to do it in pieces here and break it down as slow as possible to get an idea how this works. All right, with that, 73, take care, everyone, and have a great week, and we'll hope to do it again next week. This is K2KEY, good night, all.
Go ahead with your question, Frank.
Dick. Mel, a little while ago you spoke about the 7-8N7 tube and the 6SN7. 6SN7 sounded very familiar to me, so I went down the basement, and lo and behold, in my tube drawer, there was a 6SN7 GTV. If you need one, it's available. I'll put it in the box and send it to you.
Thank you very much. No, I don't need it at all. The 6SN7 will not directly plug into a 7N7 socket, so the person that's looking for the tube, they will just find a 7N7. They're not interchangeable directly, over.
Okay, there is a website. I was on it a few minutes ago. Somebody makes an adapter. If you're interested, I'll look it up again and send you an email.
Hold it for next week, the person that's interested in the...
Okay, Mel, 73. 2 hours, okay.